Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, in for an evening of light entertainment, I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today, we've got what will be hopefully a very funny and illuminating topic for you.
Particularly if you stand too close.
Right.
You yourself might be illuminated.
Yes, with a healthy blue glow of the Cherenkov variety.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to ask a rather strange question today. We've talked about traditional vehicles of all kinds, fossil fuels. We've talked about electric vehicles. We've talked about fuel cell vehicles.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question.
All right.
That may have sort of an obvious answer.
Several obvious answers right off the bat. Yeah.
But it's also more interesting than you might expect. Why don't we have nuclear-powered vehicles? Now, stay with me for a second.
Well, first we do, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, okay.
We have some.
We will talk about some. But I got this bizarre image in my head of a nuclear-powered airplane. Now, the airplanes we have today that we fly, you know, they use jet fuel and they use a lot of it.
Right.
And burning all that jet fuel, of course, comes with some problems we've talked about on the podcast before. I mean, those emissions are not without consequences. And, of course, the jet fuel is very expensive and it limits the range of the plane.
You have to refuel basically all the time.
Yeah. And then we've got all these nice little alternatives like these solar airplanes we've talked about. But, of course, those are great, not to downplay that at all. Like, the solar impulse is a very amazing and interesting achievement in technical design.
Sure.
But it's a very delicate thing.
It's incredibly limited in what it can do.
Yeah, it doesn't have a lot of payload capacity. It's got those problems.
It's not generating enough electricity for it to do much else than keep it aloft. So it couldn't be something that we would convert into, say, a passenger jet.
Right. So what about the possibility of something like a nuclear-powered airplane? Because when you talk about nuclear energy, suddenly there you say, oh, okay, you can generate massive amounts of power.
Right.
You can have lots of range. Like, you don't need to refuel a nuclear reactor for potentially years, depending on, you know, what your fuel is and how the reactor is designed and things like that. You could build the kind of airplane that we always imagine as being the perfect solution to a zombie outbreak on Earth. The airplane that never has to land.
At least a solution that would allow you to find, you know, a more permanent place to stay, because eventually you would run out of food. So, but you would definitely be able to fly around until you were able to discover right. that perfect uninhabited island that is yet completely covered with food generating resources.
Well, you could hunt birds.
Yeah.
And you could grow crops on the top of the plane.
Right, sure. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Green rooms in your airplane, of course. My objection
is withdrawn.
Okay, so, but extending that beyond airplanes.
Sure.
What about airplanes, cars, motorcycles, boats? What is the possibility of actually creating nuclear-powered vehicles? And I know you at home are thinking, well, wait a minute, what about all the radioactive waste? Yes, we are considering that, and we're going to talk about it. But let's just play with this for a second and see if anything comes of it.
Sure. And the wacky thing is, you're not the first person who this has occurred to, Joe.
No. In fact, there have been entire government agencies dedicated to trying to figure out if we could create a nuclear-powered aircraft, for example.
Yeah, weirdos in the Air Force asked this question way back in 1946.
Yeah, so you know, embrace your fellow weirdos. Yeah, this was...
You come from a long line and a proud history of
yes.
total weirdos.
So in 1946, the U.S. Army Air Forces, which would later just be called the Air Force, created the Nuclear Energy for the Propulsion of Aircraft, NEPA. Eventually, that would be replaced by a different acronym program called Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion, or just ANP. And they were looking at the potential of using nuclear power to generate enough electricity to power an aircraft, keep it in the air, specifically for military purposes. So this was during the era of the post-World War II, entering into the Cold War era. We're having the capability of keeping an aircraft in flight perpetually in case you needed to, I don't know, drop bombs on your enemy was of a very high priority at the time. So this was predating the intercontinental ballistic missile, right? Mm-hmm. So people were still very much concerned about the possibility of using bombers instead of missiles. And the program ended up eventually converting two Convair B-36 aircraft, which were hybrid prop jet engine aircraft bombers. All right. So these were pre-existing aircraft that had been in use already, and then said, well, why don't we go ahead and try and convert one of these to see if it could carry a nuclear reactor and do so safely. So this was just a test platform. It wasn't, the nuclear reactor was not, if you think of it this way, it wasn't hooked up to anything. It wasn't powering the plane's systems, but it was an air-cooled nuclear reactor that was put in the bombing bay of these two different Convair B-36 aircraft and operated to see if it would in fact be safe. And they had to obviously drastically alter the aircraft to make certain that the crew would remain safe. And they were shielded by 12 tons of lead and rubber between them and the reactor.
Wow.
And by the way, this particular type of aircraft is also known as the Peacemaker because, of course it is.
Because war is peace.
Exactly. Right. You might just refer back to our Doublethink episode. It made 47 test flights over Texas, mainly. And ultimately, they decided to not incorporate this as a full design, mainly because the engines that they were using had evolved to a point where it was no longer practical to use that particular approach. So it was abandoned largely because the surrounding technology of aircraft had gone further while they were still testing out the viability of having a nuclear reactor on board an aircraft.
I believe back on Tech Stuff a long time ago, you and I did a Lockheed Martin series, like two or three episodes that talked a lot about the advances that were going on in jet engines in that era.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And there was a lot of them.
Yeah.
Go figure. Like, after World War II, people were really interested in it.
Ramjets and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. But of course, as we alluded to, there are some both obvious reasons and perhaps less than obvious reasons why we don't really have nuclear powered airplanes today. And we'll get to the obvious one first, safety.
Sure.
I mean, what if a plane crashed and sprayed radioactive material all over the place? That would be very bad.
And if it's military, then there's always the possibility it could be shot down. So it's not just a mechanical failure, but you're talking about specifically placing some of these aircraft in harm's way because that is their purpose.
Right. Yeah. What happens if there's a meltdown? What happens if it leaks in some way? We've seen it doesn't have to be a full meltdown for there to be some kind of leak of like water or steam or
like
some
Three
kind
Mile
of
Island
irradiated material. Right. Yeah. And then, of course, there is the issue of passenger safety, like you were talking about in this other aircraft that had actually been created. You'd have to shield the people on the plane to protect them from what was happening in the reactor.
Yep.
And I'm sure that introduces problems for aircraft design. You typically don't want to be introducing lots of heavy materials like lead and stuff into your aircraft.
Well, especially depending on what its purpose is. If it's for cargo, then you are impacting how much cargo you're going to be able to carry, right?
Right.
Because the heavier you make that aircraft, the more powerful it needs to be. And you know, the design has to change. So when you get to a point where just the power system alone on the aircraft is that heavy, it starts creating other things you have to consider before you ever get to the point of actually loading the plane up and taking off.
Yeah. And then, of course, on top of that, it's got the problems that just come with all nuclear power, right?
Yeah.
That you have
it's regular stationary, non-flying nuclear engines. Yeah.
Right. You end up with this hazardous material that you have to find some way of dealing with and hoping that nobody gets into it for 10,000 years.
Yeah, we talked about that in previous episodes, and that is, I mean, that's a non-trivial problem.
Right.
The solutions of nuclear power, where you have lower carbon footprint, or non-existent carbon footprint, depending upon the implementation, and the fact that you don't have to refuel. All those sort of things are fantastic, but the downside of having, where do you put the spent fuel that still is very potentially dangerous, is a big issue. And it's one that governments have not fully agreed upon yet. There have been a lot of debates about what's the safest way of dealing with that.
And, so, and really, the answer to that question is nobody knows.
Yeah, so. Yeah. There may be, it may be one of those situations where you're like, well, if we decide that nuclear power, in fact, makes the most sense out of, you know, all the different arrangements that we could have, we still have to figure out, like, what's the maybe the least bad option of dealing with nuclear waste. No one really wants to deal with that problem.
No, we're in a kind of like ongoing kick the can mode right now.
Yeah. So kick the big old nuclear can. So that is something that has obviously been a deterrent in developing nuclear powered vehicles. It's not the only one. Cost is a big one.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. All of these problems that we're talking about are technically solvable, but at great expense.
Yeah, really great expense. I mean, designing a nuclear reactor is not cheap. And then designing one specifically that'll fit within a vehicle, also not cheap. Outfitting that vehicle so that it shields anyone from potential radiation, not cheap. So eventually you get to a point where the cost of the vehicle may be so high that from a financial perspective, it makes no sense to go with that as opposed to a more conventional style vehicle, whether it's an aircraft, a car, or whatever. So that's
right.
A big limiting factor.
The fact that you don't have to refuel for 100 years is balanced out by the fact that it took you more than 100 times, for example, the cost of what that fuel would have been in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. The other thing, I think one of you made this note, but I think it's a really good point. How do you, like, do the work? So you're talking about not just carrying a nuclear reactor on board, but somehow using the energy created by that reactor to do mechanical work, like spin a propeller blade.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that actually, you know, when I was a kid, I just thought, oh, it's just you got the glowing pellet, and you put the glowing pellet in this chamber, and then you close the door in the chamber, and then the wheels move. It didn't occur to me, what is the actual process that we, you know, what is nuclear power doing that allows us to generate electricity or mechanical power? And more often than not, this is not the only way, but it's the main way. We're talking about nuclear fission, where you're having atoms split up and those particles end up going on to create more nuclear reactions within a fuel rod. That generates a lot of heat. That heat ends up superheating water, converting it to steam, which then turns turbines. So you've got like a super-powered steam engine is what it comes down to.
Really, at its core, you are harnessing the power of the heavens in order to get a steam engine.
Yeah. You're just, everything that.
But it's one heck of a steam.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Extremely efficient.
Yeah. So, you know, those turbines are what, generally speaking, generate electricity or mechanical motion to turn a propeller, that sort of thing. That's not the only way. We will talk about some other ways that you can, not necessarily you, but that we could use nuclear power to generate electricity in order to do work that is not directly related to nuclear fission. But that's probably the most common way.
Well, let's get away from my nuclear plane fantasy and ground this podcast in some reality first. And
sure.
We'll talk about some more wacky stuff toward the end, but there actually are vehicles right now that use nuclear power. They exist.
Yeah. And they exist for good reason.
Yeah. Well, one big example, of course, is nuclear submarines.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen The Hunt for Red October?
Oh, I mean, so many times.
Well, you know, there is the scene where they have what they believe to be. Right. Yeah. About Alec Baldwin.
Don't react well to bullets.
You remember the scene in it where suddenly they have radiation leaking, or at least they say they do, and they have to evacuate. They have to vent with the outside air and have the crew come outside and stand on top of the submarine up in the ocean. I mean, that's a real concern because these submarines have nuclear reactors inside them.
Yeah. First, we should stress not all submarines are nuclear powered.
Certainly not.
And not all Navy vessels are nuclear powered, but a lot of them are. And when you think about the reasons, it makes sense. Like a submarine's purpose, for the military anyway, is it's kind of a stealth vehicle, right? It's able to pass underneath and to be used in various military applications, including warfare. And you want to limit the number of times you need to surface in order to preserve the safety of that vehicle and its crew.
It's kind of like the upside down version of my never landing zombie escape plane.
Yeah,
exactly. So the nuclear reactors aboard submarines allow for the generation of electricity and the propulsion of the submarine so that you don't have to surface unless you need to resupply or, a tour of duty or whatever is over. So during the Cold War, the United States was looking at developing this technology because before they were all diesel-powered submarines. So they would eventually have to resurface to refuel, and then they could go back down again. So they started looking at developing nuclear propulsion systems specifically for submarines. And the first one was the USS Nautilus, which was launched in 1955. It was also the first submarine to reach the North Pole underwater.
Interesting.
Obviously. I mean, you wouldn't think it would fly over the North Pole. It's a submarine. But
I don't know. They get some great airtime.
Yeah, they can. You know, if you've seen Hunt for October again, the captain has forced them out of the water. In the early 1960s, we started seeing other Navy vessels use nuclear fission to power propulsion. The first aircraft carrier to do so was the USS Enterprise. Which was actually the second Enterprise. And if you want to hear more about that, Scott Benjamin and I did an episode of Tech Stuff on how aircraft carriers work.
Oh, cool.
And we talked about the transition from the traditional steam-powered submarine aircraft carriers, I should say, to the nuclear-powered ones. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty cool.
Another benefit of putting this type of engine on a submarine is that it's real easy to cool nuclear engines using water.
Yeah.
That is, in fact, how many nuclear power plants cool their reactors.
Yeah. Right. You'll often see a nuclear power plant right next to a body of water.
And
right.
Submarines are in the water.
So. Yeah. So the naval reactors use very similar methodology to the power plants that you would see on land. You have a nuclear core. You've got nuclear rods that are able to, once you initiate a nuclear reaction, they're able to sustain it. You have some material that can absorb neutrons. That's one of the things that are given off in nuclear reactions. So you put the absorbing material down to help dampen the reaction. That's what allows you to have a controlled reaction as opposed to an uncontrolled reaction.
Which is bad.
Yeah. Uncontrolled reaction is essentially an atomic bomb. That's what you get with an uncontrolled reaction. So this allows to prevent things like a meltdown. And then the water cools the system as well. And plus the water gets superheated. It remains in pressurized lines. So because the lines are pressurized, it keeps the water under such pressure that it doesn't boil off into steam. It stays in liquid form, but it's superheated. It then goes to an area where it will be able to turn turbines. At that point, it's allowed to expand, so the pressure is removed. That means it immediately boils off into steam, very high-powered steam, turns these turbines. Now, the turbines may only be used to generate electricity, or they might do two things. They might generate electricity, and they might have a gearbox associated with them that can translate the rotation of the turbines into a rotational force for the actual propellers.
Oh, so it skips the middleman.
Yeah, so you could have, some vessels use essentially a giant electrical motors to turn the propellers, and then you just generate the electricity with the nuclear power. And some have this combination where you're generating electricity for the ship, but you're also generating mechanical energy for the propellers.
Hmm.
It's pretty neat. So those are the vehicles that use nuclear power right now as propulsion systems. And again, it's not that every nation uses this, but many do. So it's not rare.
What I want to know is when I can get a nuclear powered luxury sedan.
There've been some talk about nuclear powered cars.
There's been talk. Yeah, sure.
Some of it's just talk.
The practical answer to your question is never.
Yeah.
Well,
sorry.
Joe. This was the thing that when I had this harebrained idea for an episode, this was the thing that made me say, okay, well, we have to do this. Because I looked it up and I was like, oh, somebody thought it would be funny to actually design a Ford concept car with a nuclear propulsion system.
Yeah.
Well, not just funny, but an effective marketing tool for the Ford Motor Company.
Right.
I got to
right.
say, that thing looked like a major boat. I mean, it would have been.
Oh, man. No, it looks
Can you
so
imagine
cool.
Oh, no. I
Parallel
I,
like, parking in it.
I'm, it looks like a like it looks like the Batmobile if the Batmobile had been designed for George Jetson. It's gorgeous.
I'm fine with the design. I love the design. I just think, yeah, finding a parking space for that thing would be a nightmare.
We are talking about the Ford Nucleon.
The yeah. Ford Nucleon. Okay, so. First things first, it should come as no surprise to anyone that this car was never actually built.
No, it was a
it
concept
was a concept.
Car.
It never yeah. made it out of the 3/8 size model
but
stage.
Yeah. What was the deal with this concept
so,
car?
Well, it's a little complicated in the sense that, you know, it was such a concept that they didn't really define a lot of things. It was supposed to be nuclear powered. And they said that you could drive 5,000 miles, which is more than 8,000 kilometers, before needing to refuel or recharge, which is interesting. I mean, actually, according to Stanford University, if you really had a nuclear-powered car, you might be able to go between 3 to 5 years before you ever needed to refuel, which sounds pretty nice, really.
Yeah.
But, of course, you still have radioactivity. You still have to shield everybody from the nuclear core itself, so that would end up adding a lot of weight to your car. So your car would be incredibly heavy. Possibly so heavy that you would have to worry about certain elements of infrastructure, like old bridges, things like that, things that you might not want to, you know, you might not otherwise consider because you'd be in a car that might not seem that big, but it'd be really heavy.
But it could potentially outweigh like your giant Mack trucks.
Or at least be on an equivalent weight. And also, mm-hmm. I mean, with that weight comes problems with momentum, right? I mean, if you're traveling at a certain speed and your car is a certain weight, then your brakes need to be extra good.
Right.
You know, there's some problems there.
Certainly.
But yeah, like Lauren was saying. They never built a full one, and they never really defined how the nuclear power worked.
Yeah, since they never really intended for it to be a production car, it was really just a concept published in a brochure in 1958 or so. They weren't even interested in the sticky details of whether this thing would be powered by nuclear fission or nuclear fusion. They were kind of like, know, whatever scientists want to come up
with. The power of the atom.
Right, totally. The last line of the brochure is such a kicker. It said, and I quote, "Cars such as the Nucleon illustrate the extent to which research into the future is conducted at Ford Motor Company and point up the designer's unwillingness to admit that a thing cannot be done simply because it has not been done."
Right. Yeah, so this is right there in the smack dab middle of the atomic age where atomic was going to be considered the solution to all our problems, energy and otherwise.
Oh, well, yeah. It was also that crazy 1950s car boom where
sure.
everyone in America was buying 98 different cars so that they could have so much freedom.
Of course, it was also right in the middle of when every movie plot was, well, there's a regular animal that's been made into a giant dangerous animal because of nuclear atomic radiation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a not a consensus on the matter, as it turns out, in PR terms. Also, you know, I think they talked about it just being like it would be powered by an atomic pellet. That's about as close as they got to explaining how it was working. So, you know, since this was such a concept, when you talk about a concept car, you can't get much more conceptual than this very vague description. But the design is pretty sweet.
It was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And, you know, but so, yes, I would posit that it is really just an artifact of the atomic age and that no one would obviously take anything like that seriously outside of that contemporary culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly. We left all that behind in the 1950s, right?
Yeah, no, not at all.
What? What?
In 2009 at the Chicago Auto Show, GM via Cadillac presented a concept car that looked like a Ford Nucleon designed for modern Batman, actually.
Wow.
No George Jetson in this version.
No George Jetson in this one, no, sorry. Yeah, this is the Cadillac World Thorium Fuel.
I'm looking at a picture of this now.
So the nuclear engine idea here had been updated to a proposal for a thorium-based system, which we've talked about previously on the show, not for cars, but you can check out our full episode on it from March 21st, 2014, if you would like. But basically, so thorium is a radioactive material that's more abundant than uranium and has a greater energy yield, possibly 200 times greater, and it's hypothetically safer than a uranium reactor because it won't melt down. When you lose power, the process just stops naturally.
Oh, right. So you don't have to worry about lowering that material I was talking about that soaks up those neutrons.
Mm-hmm, sure. And the materials and byproducts are not quite as easy to weaponize as a normal uranium reactor. The design for this concept car from Cadillac was done by one Lauren Klesis, who created it with the idea that it could go largely without maintenance for 100 years.
Wow.
Which seems just optimistic to me. This was partially due to having backup systems for everything in case of failure. I think the engine itself was the only thing that didn't have a primary backup. And this is my favorite part. It included these really like weird looking deep well wheels that actually consisted of 6 mini wheels, each powered by its own induction motor. So you never have to change the tires, only take them in for realignment every 5 years or so.
I'm looking at this picture. I can't imagine it having that many backup systems because this thing in certain areas looks like it's paper thin.
I don't know. I don't know. You know, even though Klesis thought the idea through maybe a little bit more than the Nucleon designers, GM was not really planning on taking the concept any further. Top Gear nicknamed the concept the Cadillac WTF, which, to be fair, is the acronym.
Classic Top Gear.
Uh-huh. So, you know, again, like, who would possibly try to make a thorium engine? No one would actually be working on that.
I sense that you're going to say they are.
Yeah, no, someone's totally working on that.
Okay.
Charles Stevens with the Massachusetts, Connecticut R&D firm Laser Power Systems around 2011 started hyping this model of a thorium-based motor that they had been developing. The concept is this. You use the thorium to create a laser to create steam, to turn a turbine, to generate electricity, to power a vehicle.
So this is a steam-powered car using a thorium laser to generate the steam?
Yes.
Wow. So Dr. Evil drives this car is what I'm hearing.
I'm pretty sure. And Charles Stevens, who's the CEO of this company, said that it would weigh about 500 pounds, which is the approximate weight of a regular old car engine. So that checks out. And he said that it could run on 8 grams of thorium for about 100 years, a.k.a. some 300,000 miles. According to their website, they're working on scaling the system, which, by the way, they call the Max Phelaser. I think I'm saying that right.
Wow.
Max Phelaser.
Max Phelaser. For use in all kinds of vehicles, you know, boats and airplanes and spaceships and et cetera, and also for powering homes and businesses.
Huh.
Well, I mean, of course, the idea of some sort of thorium-based power for homes and businesses is not unusual.
No, that's the more common way of thinking about thorium-fueled reactors, sure.
Where do we stand on this?
Well, Digital Trends reached out to Laser Power Systems back in 2014, and they responded that Stevens didn't, and I quote, have time to comment.
Wow, that's how busy that cat is, huh?
But Laser Power Systems is still soliciting to investors through their website to help them create and test their designs for the system.
Of course they are, yeah. I mean, he's not too busy to accept money.
Right? Right?
I guess I'll have to register my skepticism, not knowing that much more about it, but I mean, at least it sounds interesting.
Yeah,
I'd like to read more about that.
I don't know that the proposed system is implausible. I do wonder more. Again, I mean, we still have some of the same issues that we have with the other examples we've talked about, you know, you do have to still, we are still talking about radiation. We are still talking about the need for shielding and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's, the question I have ultimately is, assuming that actually goes forward, what will the law have to say? But we're still not there yet.
Oh, yeah. Way back from the law needing to worry about it.
Is it legal to possess enriched uranium in the trunk of your car?
Are you asking for a reason?
No, I mean,
because if you're about to tell me that we need to go and unload your car, I'm going to say I am not going there.
I'd have to check, but I suspect not.
I consider y'all friends, but y'all aren't those friends for me. I've got other friends I call to help dispose of my enriched uranium.
That's fair.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, but while these concept cars are not a real thing, and maybe we shouldn't ever expect them to be a real thing, nuclear-powered rolling vehicles, there are actually nuclear-powered rolling vehicles, just not so much on planet Earth.
Are you referring to the Curiosity rover?
Well, yeah, and just generally the idea of using some form of nuclear-based propulsion in space vehicles.
Right.
Oh, sure, because that's really clever. Because, again, like, you can't, there's no gas stations on Mars that we've found.
No.
And if you're sending a probe out to the deep reaches of space, there aren't any rest stops. So
that we found.
That we found.
Right. So I remember back in the day, I think years ago, we were recording a podcast about the Curiosity rover, and I made a mistake. I just assumed, I was like, okay, well, it's powered by solar panels, like all, you know, like rovers are. But then I was like, better check that. And I went back and checked it out. Turns out that was not true.
Yeah.
It was powered by, it has a nuclear-based power source, but it's not like the nuclear reactors that power our homes.
Right. It's not based on fission. It's based on just radioactive decay. So you can think of it kind of like a battery, a nuclear battery. It's 5 kilograms in mass, or about 10 pounds in weight. And it is consists of plutonium-238.
One of my favorite plutonium isotopes.
Absolutely lovely, isn't it? Is it not?
Mm-hmm. So dreamy.
And it uses what's called a thermocouple, which is something that you will find in a lot of electronics here on Earth, specifically digital thermometers. And its principle is pretty cool. So you take two different metals, all right, and you join them in a couple different places. And the difference in temperature from one joining to another creates voltage, which is a difference in charge. Difference in charge means electrons can flow. You can create a current. Now, with digital thermometers, we use this to indicate what the temperature is in a room. So the temperature difference between the two joints ends up creating this voltage, electricity flows, and the amount of electricity that flows indicates what the temperature is, which is told to you in a little digital readout. Because clearly, just saying it's this much electricity would be meaningless to us, but it would end up translating that into saying it is 72 degrees in this room. I'm using the example in
it
our
is,
room.
It is 4 pies hot.
So anyway, a thermocouple is used in the Curiosity rover as well. So the plutonium-238 ends up generating heat, and that heat is used to heat the one of the joints on the thermocouple, and the other one is unheated so that you get this difference in heat that creates the voltage, which then allows electricity to flow, which allows the this nuclear battery to provide electricity to the Curiosity rover system. And it's called a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, or RTG.
Right. And it's not just the Curiosity rover that has used this as a power source for space.
Right. In fact, we've used this since the Apollo program. We've used it also on things like the Voyager probes. But in the case of Apollo, it was not the device that created electricity for the actual capsule. This is still dealing with a radioactive material that is decaying over time. It was used, however, on the moon's surface. So, you know, Apollo's 12 through 17, they had lunar landers that were designed to create operations on the moon. They used RTGs to generate the electricity they needed for the experiments they did on the moon's surface, as well as the lunar rovers, I believe, to charge them. So, out of all the ones that we created for the Apollo program, 5 of them are on the surface of the moon. One of them is in the Pacific. And that's thanks to Apollo 13. So if Tom Hanks never made that movie, we wouldn't have had the RTG. And actually, I don't think it works that way.
Thanks, Tom Hanks. Thank you for all the science.
Somebody at the bottom of the Pacific is enjoying a plutonium snack at this very moment.
Yeah. Have you seen The Host? I think this is how it starts.
Oh, no.
At any rate, no. I am making light of what was really a very serious situation.
It was. Yeah.
RTGs, clearly, like, again, you've got plutonium there. There is a concern. In fact, there were a lot of concerns about using RTGs in the space program, specifically because there was a fear that if there were a launch issue, then you could potentially spread a radioactive material over a very large space, depending upon how high in the altitude you were when that problem happened.
Sure, but, it's similar to the one of the concerns about flying a plane with a nuclear reactor.
Right. Now, we have still used RTGs, including the Huygens probe, which was sent to Titan, Saturn's moon Titan. I did an episode of Forward Thinking about that, where we talked about what the Huygens probe did and the images that it sent back. The Cassini-Huygens probe used an RTG for its electrical power. So it's something that is still being used. And again, it's using radioactive decay, not the process of fission, in order to generate that power. So it's very different.
Right. So these RTGs are going to be great to do something like drive around and power electronics on the Curiosity rover. But you probably wouldn't use something like this for a vehicle here on Earth.
Probably not. I mean, you are still talking about radiation again.
Yeah.
That's an issue. Also, radioactive decay over time is like you have a certain amount of radioactive material, right? As it decays, less of that is going to decay, thus giving you the ability to create electricity, however, whatever method you're planning on using. And the decay itself, we've talked about this, you know, we talk about truly random. So the decay itself is something that is not necessarily going to be consistent over the entire lifetime of the nuclear battery or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So for a vehicle, it's not necessarily going to produce enough electricity to power something like a spacecraft for an indefinite amount of time, nor is it going to be something that's always going to be dependable. And if you think your car is undependable now...
yeah, this is a long, slow burn of it's Schrodinger's engine, whether or not your car is going to turn
right.
on every morning.
I don't... who knows if it's decayed enough for me to drive? I don't know.
Okay, yeah. I've got a crazier and dumber idea.
Yeah?
Okay.
I can't wait to hear it.
What if we just basically use nuclear bombs to sort of push us through space?
Well, you know, Joe, you say that's a crazy idea, as if you were the first person to have it.
No, I know I'm not.
No, This was something, and it's funny because just before we started recording this, we were chatting with Joe and I were chatting with Jason, who's our kind of our head honcho here at How Stuff Works, and we were talking about a particular project called Project Orion, which before it was Project Orion was just this crazy idea some guys had about, you know, atomic reactions create, there's so much energy associated with them, right? I mean, you see an atomic bomb, you realize that's an enormous amount of energy that's released. And we talk about that being like the uncontrolled release of energy from an atomic reaction, fission specifically in that case. Well, also you could do it with fusion, like a hydrogen bomb. And there were some folks who were looking at hydrogen bombs and thinking, so much energy is being released. What if there were a way for us to harness that, not in a reactor, but to actually use that to propel something? One of these guys, his name was Theodore Taylor, who had worked on weapons programs at Los Alamos. And he, along with several other physicists, started looking at the possibility of using hydrogen-based explosions to propel a spacecraft into space. We call it Project Orion. This was an idea that was brought under the auspices of DARPA, which was ARPA at the time, in the 1950s. And essentially, the idea was that you would drop behind you a pellet of some sort and a hydrogen bomb. The bomb explodes. It ends up plasmifying the pellet, and the combination ends up propelling you further along your path. They called it pulse propulsion,
nuclear pulse
propulsion, meaning we're talking a series of hydrogen bombs. Not you drop one bomb.
The one.
No.
Sure. Like a whole bunch.
Yeah.
No, I've seen geeks on the internet discussing this as one potential way to get a spacecraft to keep accelerating toward the speed of light, as you have nuclear pulse propulsion continually blowing up behind it.
Yeah, clearly this would be a dangerous thing to for liftoff. you know, but if you were using, I don't know, chemical rockets to get into orbit and then switch to this method of propulsion, that would be one thing. If you were using,
that would be one dangerous thing.
Yeah,
I guess less dangerous than an actual nuclear explosion on the planet's surface. But
yeah, so yeah, I mean, it is an interesting idea that no one has really pursued since that time. But there were people, I mean, like top scientists really working on the potential of using this as a means of getting into space.
Well, this again was in the middle of that atomic age where everyone was like, yes.
Yeah.
Then again, I don't know. I don't know if this has necessarily been discredited as a future potential propulsion system. I mean,
it's, well, the only thing I would imagine it being discredited would be in the sense of arms treaties.
Yeah.
Because you would have to build
huge
numbers of hydrogen bombs as your propulsion system. Meanwhile, the rest of the world.
Good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, the rest of the world has to sit there and say, oh, it's fine for you to build an arsenal of hydrogen bombs that could destroy the world three times over because you're just going to Mars.
Sure. And there's also, I'm pretty sure, international laws against putting hydrogen bombs in space.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The weaponization of space is completely against the rules.
Yeah.
There was a space treaty. Weapons of mass destruction are not allowed in space.
Let alone a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
So I think that for, I mean, also just the material science of trying to build out a spaceship that could withstand multiple hydrogen bombs going off right behind it into perpetuity. Sounds difficult to me. I mean, I'm sure like 20 to 40 years we'll have it worked out.
It also makes me think, like, one of the byproducts of atomic explosions tends to be an electromagnetic pulse, which generally speaking is not good for electronics. So I'm curious as to how that gets avoided too.
Nanobots.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. But how about a different version? How about the thermal nuclear drive? It's another proposed method of propulsion using nuclear power.
Right. Well, this would be using nuclear reactions to generate heat.
Yeah.
To trigger a reaction engine, right?
Essentially, you are superheating a gas.
Yeah.
And then you have a nozzle that allows you to exhaust that superheated gas. You know, by superheating it, you are increasing its volume, right? But mm-hmm. if you have it pressurized so it can't increase beyond the confines of it, the pressurization increases. You open up a nozzle, it allows the gas to escape. It creates an opposite force on the, you know, in the opposite direction, equal but opposite reaction type deal.
Like a fire extinguisher in a cartoon.
Yep, exactly. And then you just... You go super fast.
That's actually the technical term.
It actually is. It's very difficult to spell. There's like a P and like 14 S's. So the information I've read has suggested that this approach, which by the way would still be using nuclear fission for the actual reaction. So you'd have a nuclear reactor the way you would on a power plant here on Earth, except obviously designed for a spacecraft. But it would be, in theory, it would give you twice the performance of chemical rockets. However, it would also necessitate a much heavier spacecraft because you would have to have all the things we talked about before, the shielding and the nuclear fuel itself, and also the gas that you're going to be using as the propellant. All of that would still be a consideration. But the U.S. began exploring use of nuclear propulsion for spacecraft in the 1950s. They formed the Nuclear Engine for Rocket Vehicle Application, called NERVA, to explore the possibilities. And they proved the feasibility of such a propulsion system. There was even talk of using it in a manned mission to Mars back in the 70s, but it never went very far. By then, the space race was starting to wind down. People had essentially said, we've proven what we need to prove. Congress was cutting funding. So programs were being canceled, and this was one of the ones that got canceled. But I had heard some interesting stories about how using this, we could get to Mars much faster than if we were using traditional chemical rockets, like within 3 months instead of 8.
Oh, wow.
Which is, pretty significant. And by that significance, it also means that you expose astronauts to radiation for much less time.
Except for the radiation that they're being exposed to from the vehicle itself.
That's a fair point. I was thinking specifically cosmic radiation, but
sure.
Your terrestrial radiation is still a very fair concern. But yeah, it's one of those things that, maybe in the future will be explored again. But anytime we get to nuclear propulsion, there's also always the concern about could that be used for other purposes.
Oh, sure, sure. And actually, I'm sure that if you were shielding a nuclear propulsed, I'm just going to verb that noun. Yeah, totally. A vehicle like that, you would come up with really great shielding for cosmic radiation as well.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about protecting ourselves against very high energy particles, whether it's from, the again, a radiation from a nuclear reactor or cosmic sources. There are some other means of generating electricity using nuclear processes that don't require you to undergo fission. There are these things that are in development called nuclear batteries, not like the one on the Curiosity rover. That's a slightly different approach. But they again, would also generate electricity through radioactive decay. But we're talking about harnessing beta particles, which are kind of mid-powered, essentially electrons. They have a negative charge. They have very little mass, but they are expelled from the nucleus of radioactive isotopes.
Yeah, so like in beta decay, for example, when carbon-14 decays back into nitrogen-14, it has beta decay. It ejects a beta particle, and then suddenly it's got one more proton inside the nucleus.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you can use all sorts of different isotopes, including things like heavy hydrogen, as in hydrogen-3. There's a couple different versions of heavy hydrogen, but this is specifically hydrogen-3 we're talking about. And if you harness those using semiconductors, then you can actually use that as a source for electricity. But similar to what we were talking about before, since you're depending on radioactive decay, it could be too slow to provide the electricity needed to power a vehicle. However, this might be something that eventually ends up recharging your cell phone without you needing to plug your phone in. Like, your phone is constantly charging using a nuclear battery that could just be generating enough electricity to recharge your traditional battery to keep your phone going. So you never have to plug it in. Like, your phone's battery would essentially last as long as you wanted to use that phone, keeping in mind that most of us end up upgrading our phones after a few years anyway.
For me, that is worth putting a nuclear thing on my face.
Yeah. Just hold it right up to your brain pan. That's where I like to put nuclear things.
Well, they always said I had the brain pan of a stagecoach tilter.
Is that what they always say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, on that note, let's take one look at another possible use of nuclear power.
Yeah, we have been talking all of this time about radioactive decomposition,
right,
and also fission.
Right. Yeah, the only time we mentioned fusion at all was using hydrogen bombs to propel a spacecraft. But what about fusion reactors? We've mentioned
that.
What
about them?
Okay, so this is one of those things that, you know,
do we have them yet?
Kind of, yes. Yes, we do have fusion reactors.
Do we have good ones yet?
Okay, all right.
And that's the thing. We've done entire episodes about this, and they do work, just not efficiently at all.
Right,
it takes more energy to make them go than you get out of them.
Right, or if you are able to get enough energy out where it's equivalent or more than the energy you put in, it still only consumes a tiny percentage of the fuel, which means you end up with a bunch of unused fuel at the end of your reaction, and it's still not efficient. You're getting more energy out than you're putting in, but you're not using efficient use of the fuel itself. So we've seen some very dramatic improvements in the technology, because for the longest time, it was like you would pour in 100% energy and get 60% back from the reaction. Mm-hmm. Clearly, that's not going to be sustainable. It's an energy loss at that point.
Right. It's not an engine so much as it is an interesting science experiment.
It's a sinkhole is what it is. But we've gotten much better about that. So fusion could actually be far more powerful than chemical rockets, fusion-powered rockets. You would be, like the name sounds, you fuse two nucleuses together to create a new one, and in the process that releases a lot of energy. And it could potentially make things like a trip to Mars take much less time than what it does now. So we talked about this when the Curiosity was sent to Mars. It took about 8 months, I think, from the point where it launched to the point where it set down on Mars. And that's because, again, we have to wait for the ideal amount of time where Earth and Mars are going to be close to being in alignment.
Share the best window. And then, yeah. I mean, obviously it's a rover. It's not traveling at the speed of light. It's traveling at the speed of rover.
So. Right. So, and then if we want to send people there, the big concern was that, well, they're going to have to wait for 2 years before we get to that point where the Earth and Mars are getting close together again, because we won't have enough fuel to send them there and then have them come back and have that trip last a really long time. We have to make the best use of physics in order to conserve fuel and give them a chance to get there and get back. But we've mentioned this before. Mars is totally trying to kill you. Mars is not a nice place. It is not going to be a cakewalk for anyone who goes there. So you don't really want people to spend a long time there if you can prevent it. So one of the possibilities is using fusion-based rockets, which could get you to Mars in around 3 months. In fact, the estimation I saw was that a proposed mission would take 87 days to get to Mars. You could spend 30 days on Mars, and then it would be like a 93-day trip back to Earth. So you would end up having much less exposure to things like cosmic radiation, mm-hmm. At least during the trip. Once you're on the surface of Mars, you got to figure out something there. But on the trip there, you would spend less time in space. Therefore, you would have less of a risk of being exposed to things like cosmic radiation, which is bad news. Interesting proposal. It would be fusing things like the two different versions of heavy hydrogen, deuterium and tritium. So hydrogen 2 and hydrogen 3, in other words. And that would create a plasma. So you get these bubbles that are in this plasma. And this is the super weird way that I think is fascinating. Weird way to actually create fusion. You get these bubbles in the plasma.
Mm-hmm.
You then capture the bubbles, you surround them with metal rings, and you use a magnetic field to compress that bubble.
Huh.
And the magnetic field is powerful enough to compress that bubble to the point where fusion takes place.
Huh.
The release of the energy from fusion is so great that it vaporizes the metal that has surrounded that bubble. And that vaporized metal is then released in a nozzle to create the propulsion that pushes the spacecraft forward, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, vaporized metal as your fire
propellant.
Extinguisher can propellant.
Exactly.
Sure.
Okay. Well, it makes me think it's kind of like a super souped up version of what the cylinders in a car engine do. Like they compress the gas until it ignites, except now we're talking about a different level of ignition.
Well, and
a little bit warmer.
Another interesting point is that when you get to the moment where that compressed gas ignites within a cylinder, typically you're talking about a temperature that's higher than the melting point of the engine of your car. But because it happens so quickly, it's such a short amount of time that it is that temperature, it's not enough to actually melt anything. That's the same principle of this fusion approach. Like, yeah, we don't have anything on Earth that would withstand the temperatures we're talking about, but it happens so quickly.
But it doesn't need to.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Put it inside a Twinkie. It'll be fine.
So there are other ways to create fusion rockets that would propel the spacecraft in a way different than the metal rings being vaporized and then ejected into space method I just talked about. But they didn't sound as science fiction awesome crazy as the method I described. So that was the one I focused on.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you gotta have your standards. So,
you know, we didn't even mention, I don't think, icebreakers.
No.
I think icebreakers are cool. I don't have the research sitting in front of me, so it wouldn't make sense to talk about it.
Are you talking about gatherings where, like, a bunch of people get together and then just kind of try and have casual conversation in a very forced environment?
You know very well what I'm talking about, Jonathan. I'm talking about ships that probe the icy reaches of the poles when they have to... They've got to pound through some ice because that stuff gets thick.
Yeah.
So how do they generate enough thrust to crack the ice shelf and move through it? Well, they have these nuclear-powered engines. I don't think all of them do, but some of them do.
Certainly the one that found Frankenstein's monster didn't.
Obviously.
No. But, there are some other, you know, vehicles that are similar to that. We're largely talking naval vehicles. Whether we ever see any other vehicles that rely heavily upon nuclear power, I'm more than a little skeptical. I mean, it may end up being that you could argue there are going to be plenty of vehicles that will be indirectly powered by nuclear power in the sense that nuclear power will generate the electricity and you plug your car in.
Sure. Yeah. When you think about it that way, many electric vehicles right now are nuclear powered.
Right, right. But as for direct nuclear power, I am skeptical, but never say never.
Well, if we want to go down that route, we could just say that all of our things are Big Bang powered.
That's true. Just go back, go back far enough. Like, yeah, we're all related if you go back far enough. Eventually you have to sit there and say like, all right, for practical purposes for this conversation, we're going to have to just ignore that and move forward.
Yeah. I agree. I'm also kind of skeptical, at least for the near future. I don't see how it could be economically or safely feasible to, I'm so good at English words, you guys. I have a degree in this.
It would also be politically difficult. There's so many different
barriers. There's a lot of barriers. Yeah. But I can certainly envision a future 100, 200 years out wherein it becomes feasible due to material science and et cetera.
Well, one day I'm going to live on a nuclear-powered fan boat, and I'm going to dominate the swamps of southern Louisiana.
I can't wait to hear about how you wrestled the great robo-gator and claimed dominance of all your domain.
I don't believe in your future, Joe, but I like it better than mine.
Well, on that note, I want to hear about what our listeners have to say about this or any other topic, really. Anything that you wanted to hear more about. Maybe you've heard an episode that we've done in the past. You think that we need to do an update, because here's the crazy thing about the future. It keeps coming and then turning into the present. And sometimes we get things totally right, and sometimes we get things totally wrong. If you have anything you want us to revisit, or you've just got a new topic that you would love us to talk about, you should get in touch with us. Let us know what that is. Send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or drop us a line on Facebook, Google Plus, or Twitter. At Google Plus and Twitter, we are FW Thinking. At Facebook, just search FW Thinking. We'll pop right up. Leave us a message, tell us what you think, and you'll hear from us again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.